Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. And coming up on the program today, what the midterm budget means for growth, jobs, and South Africa's fragile fiscal outlook. Insurance could be Africa's next big capital engine. A 600% surge in gambling helpline calls exposes the dark side of South Africa's booming betting industry. And how money worries are silently eroding South Africans' health, productivity, and peace of mind. It's Thursday, the 13th of November. Now, to use a cliche, the Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, has struck a cautiously upbeat tone in the midterm budget, saying South Africa's debt will finally stabilize next year for the first time since 2008, and he's introduced a new 3% inflation target, promising lower long-term borrowing costs, but also warning of short-term fiscal pressure. So let's discuss what all of this means for investors and the economy. I'm in conversation with Isak Odendaal, Chief Investment Strategist at Old Mutual. So let's start with the inflation target, Isak, and thank you. How will lowering the target then affect growth and borrowing costs in the short term? Is this a good move?
I think it's a very positive development for the economy as a whole, but it does create a bit of a technical problem for the budget, which is basically when you have higher inflation that tends to organically generate more tax revenues because, you know, you get bigger salary increases every year linked to inflation. And so it just brings more money into the front door. It doesn't actually make the economy richer or more prosperous, but it, in money terms, makes the numbers look better. So that's what he means by a short-term adjustment. They've had to lower their inflation assumptions to converge on this new target. And for instance, if you think about, you know, the number that often gets quoted would be a debt to GDP ratio, a debt to nominal GDP ratio. So if the denominator in that ratio is a bit lower because of lower inflation, that obviously the ratio looks a bit higher. So that's a technical issue. The broader benefit of lower inflation really is that ultimately, if we can stabilize inflation around 3%, and remember there is a tolerance band, so 3% on the dot, the Reserve Bank can start lowering interest rates, and long bond yields, which is where the government borrows, those bond yields will start falling. And we've already seen a major decline in those bond yields already this year, I think in anticipation of a lower inflation target. So this is a very positive development in my view, and I'm very glad they announced it today and did not postpone the announcement even longer.
And broadly, this is good for price stability, is it?
Yes. I don't think anyone benefits from high inflation, unless, you know, as I said, the government tends to get more money in the front door, but that's just nominal money. It doesn't mean that we are richer or more prosperous or can buy more things with that money. So ultimately, price stability is beneficial to the economy. It makes the economy more efficient. It helps stabilize the currency, because remember, if our inflation rate is 3%, well, let's say our inflation rate is 5% and another country has an inflation rate of 2%, then over time we lose competitiveness against that country. And so the currency tends to depreciate. And that's exactly what has happened over time, is we have this weakening trend of the rand because our inflation is so much higher than, for instance, America or Europe. So this is ultimately going to be good news for the economy. Obviously, it's not going to happen overnight. Obviously, there's an adjustment process. But I think this is an important step for the long term.
Isak, the minister also saying the debt is going to stabilize for the first time since 2008. How credible do you think that claim is? And what assumptions is he building that on?
Yeah, again, it's the debt ratio. So we're expressing debt as a percentage of the expected economic activity or expected national income. So there are two components. Number one is the amount of money that you're going to borrow and how that impacts your rand amount of your debt. And then number two is how is the economy growing to give you the denominator in that ratio. So on the borrowing side, yes, you know, if you can narrow the deficit, in other words, if you can get your spending, your tax revenues closer into line, which is what's happening, then yes, you will borrow less. As I said earlier, we have lower bond yields, so the cost of borrowing is also coming down, so that helps on the margin. But then really, we also need stronger economic growth. Mm-hmm. You know, we need that upward sloping profile of economic growth, and the minister spent a lot of time talking about infrastructure projects and changing the regulations and the framework and so on, lots of acronyms. But essentially, that's the lever they tried to pull, is how do we get government spending on infrastructure to become more efficient? And how do we get the private sector to be also invest more in infrastructure so we can get faster growth and ultimately help stabilize the debt ratio?
So let's push on that a little bit. How meaningful do you think this 15 billion rand infrastructure bond is in the context of a pipeline which I think is valued at something like a trillion rand? Is that going to unlock the private capital at scale, do you think?
Yeah, the bond itself is not going to be a game changer, but I think it just shows intent. Because as you say, you know, it's 15 billion versus an overall budget of, you know, trillion. Mm. But yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is if you step back a little bit and say everyone talks about infrastructure, the private sector is very keen to invest in infrastructure, but we need to see the projects, right? We need to know what we're going to invest in. So a lot of work is happening to actually get those projects ready where they're at a stage where, you know, someone can take it to a bank and say, lend me money so I can get involved here, or a pension fund says we will put debt or equity into this project. You know, so that's where the stumbling block has been, is not the willingness to fund, but the actual projects. You know, show us the blueprints for what you want us to invest in. So we've seen the government trying to adjust the regulations around public-private partnerships to make it easier, for instance, for municipalities to embark on these projects. Created new facilities, credit guarantee facilities, as I said, lots of acronyms. Mm. But fundamentally, this is a much stronger focus on improving the efficiency of government spending on infrastructure, but also crowding in private investment.
What did you hear in the speech about tax hikes next year?
Yeah, so that's a bit of a downer as far as the MTBPS was concerned, because they did bring in 18 or 19 billion rand more tax revenue. Sorry, that's a projection for this for the full year.
Yeah,
that there'll be 19 billion more tax revenue compared to what they projected in the May budget. So that was good news, but they are still leaving the door open for a tax increase next year because they still want around 20 billion rand. And the argument has been that if we can get more efficiency from SARS point of view, then we potentially don't need the tax increase. So it's a bit vague. It's still on the cards so far. I think if the trend this year continues, then obviously we won't need that increase. Obviously, it's preferable for the economy to organically grow tax revenues rather than for the government to go and look for new tax revenues by way of for instance, a VAT increase, which caused so much unhappiness earlier in the year. Yeah. But it is unfortunately still on the cards because spending has also increased. So they've been trying to balance this whole idea of we need to close the deficit, borrow less, but at the same time, there is a huge degree of pain, especially in the education sector, in the healthcare sector, where, you know, those frontline services are struggling because of tight budgets, because of allocations being cut back. And I think, you know, so there has been about 15 billion rand relief for those frontline services in terms of additional spending. But of course, that needs to be funded somehow.
And just a quick one, Isaac, in conclusion, and let me pull the lens back slightly. We've exited the grey list. We are hosting the G20. Do you think this budget in any way, or this mini budget in any way, shifts the narrative for foreign investors? Or do you think that confidence is still on hold?
I think it's a milestone, just as the grey list exiting was a milestone. So I don't think we're going to wake up one morning and suddenly, you know, foreign investment, foreign confidence has jumped, or even domestic confidence has jumped massively. I think these are all sort of steps of demonstrating that we are on track to improving the economic outlook for the country, on track to improving the governance framework, on track to improving fiscal sustainability and so on. So it's there's not going to be one single lever that gets pulled. I think it's doing all of these things and continuously doing it right. And obviously also with the budget, you know, it's one thing for the minister to say, you know, throw around big numbers, but ultimately the implementation sits with provincial governments, with local governments, with SOEs and so on.
Yeah.
And you know, the problems there remain.
And that's the real test. Isaac Udendaal, thank you very much indeed. Chief Investment Strategist at Old Mutual. I appreciate your time and the analysis.
MoneyWeb at midday.
top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, new commentary by Sanlam Investments chief economist Arthur Camp argues that deepening insurance penetration could mobilize billions in funding for infrastructure, agriculture and small business development. Yet despite the promise, coverage across the continent I think remains alarmingly low, and that leaves households, farmers and enterprises always exposed to risk. So can Africa turn insurance into its next big growth story, and what might that take to ensure that it happens? Arthur, a very warm welcome to you. You've called insurance Africa's, and I quote, next great capital mobilizer. I think that's a bold statement. What gives you confidence that this ostensibly underdeveloped sector can deliver large-scale funding when banks, pension funds, and even DFIs have struggled to do that?
Hi, Jeremy. So I think one of the key issues here is that on our continent, we've got a very large informal sector and a lot of people unbanked. So if you look at the amount of unbanked people with, say, an account at a bank or some institution, people are 15 years and older, across our continent, on sub-Saharan Africa, it's less than 40%. If you add in mobile money accounts, it's less than 60%. So obviously, there's a lot of room for growth there. Now, if you've got 650 million users of cell phones on the continent, that does indicate that there's potential upside there, because what this does is it obviates the need for infrastructure, physical infrastructure on the ground. And if we look at the potential of mobile money apps and using AI, I think that insurers are really moving into this space. They're partnering up. FinTech solutions, I think the growth potential is enormous. And we've seen it in Kenya, for example, as well. And sort of, it's a pretty much a game changer from that perspective, an ability and a technology to be able to reach the previously unbanked. And then also, it's a needs must issue. You know, we talk about savings required for our continent or capital required for our continent. Part of the issue here is that we've got a savings problem. Many countries, you know, they borrow abroad, they borrow foreign currency, and then you get into a patch where U.S. interest rates are going up, or the dollar is strong, and there's perhaps external shocks, and they don't have enough foreign exchange reserves, and you run into these balance of payments crises, and then you have to have the IMF. So there's a strong incentive to build a domestic savings base. And here, of course, the issue on the continent is that if you look at institutional investors, they're not well represented. I mean, you made that point. But yet, if we look at the opportunities, one opportunity would be infrastructure, for example, infrastructure investment, because that's obviously the need on our continent, and it's a perfect fit for an insurer. So what you want to do here is you wanted to develop the local debt markets, for example, and the local and deepen them and make them more liquid, because obviously at the moment that's an issue. But there's a perfect fit here, because infrastructure projects, for example, insurers want to match their long-term liabilities with long-term assets. That's what investment in infrastructure can give you. In many instances, the revenue from these are linked to inflation. And so from that perspective, also, the opportunities developing, I mean, just the need on our continent for infrastructure spending is enormous. You can put these two together. So I think that there's enough catalysts there. But of course, last point I would make on this is that I think it's critical to understand that, you know, it's very difficult to argue, and I don't think you can argue, that insurance will drive growth. Causality is really difficult to prove here. I think it's one issue of it's a necessary condition for growth. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if the right policies are put in place on our continent, in terms of economic policy and broader financial policies, then we can get sort of a positive feedback loop going between the two.
And that's exactly the problem, isn't it? Regulation is often cited as the barrier, but isn't the deeper problem political? In other words, governments simply see insurers as short-term tax bases rather than, as you're suggesting, long-term investment partners.
Well, I think in terms of policy, it's not just regulations that differ between countries. Obviously, one of the problems on our continent is that you don't have deep liquid capital markets. You talk about developing regional markets, but you're not going to do that if regulation is not harmonized between different countries. And so that is a particularly important issue. Obviously, also the problem I mentioned about not having strongly represented institutional investors. So again, the incentive is there, because insurers can mobilize savings and overcome one of the biggest problems on our continent is, and we're heading into the B20 and the G20, one of the big issues here is the report on inequality, and obviously the problem with that is the high cost of borrowing on our continent. And one of the reasons for the high cost of borrowing on our continent is that there's a lack of information. You simply don't have the information, and if investors don't have enough information about a particular project or about a particular government project, they would tend to obviously bump up interest rates, and you pay higher interest rates. So there's a very strong incentive here for, you know, insurers can obviously overcome health and overcome that problem, just like banks do, because they obviously have more information than general savers on the viability and potential returns and risk of a project. So it boils down to everybody wins if there's cooperation here. Finally, I would also point out, though, as far as policymakers go, one of the issues is that if you are investing on our continent, you very often run into issues like liquidity constraints and foreign exchange, capital controls, and devaluations of currencies. So that speaks to the need on our continent also from a regulatory aspect to develop very strong institutions, and particularly independent central banks, banks that don't fund governments directly, also obviously on fiscal policy, that you have prudent policies put in place that give investors confidence. And then also, again, develop those local markets, because if you have this high level of borrowing in foreign currency, you know, this convertibility problem and liquidity problem remains at large.
And just very quickly, it's also about keeping money within the system itself. So much of Africa's premium income leaves the continent. Difficult to keep that capital circulating within African financial markets, isn't it?
Yes, I think if we look at the, very typically a developing country, when it's growing, it does invest more than it saves. It will attract foreign capital, and that foreign capital wants a dividend. Or it wants interest. So the issue is, number one, if we can lower the cost of that interest or the level of that interest to pay the cost of that borrowing by putting in prudent policies, improving information flow to investors, that will obviously help. But at the same time, your point speaks to the critical issue of developing local investor bases and savings bases, so that over time, you have less reliance on foreign capital inflows as your economy develops.
Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate the conversation. Sanlam Investments Chief Economist Arthur Camp, thank you indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, there's disturbing new data from the National Gambling Board that shows a staggering 600% spike in calls for help to the National Responsible Gambling Program, with rising cases of addiction, depression, and even suicide linked to betting. And psychiatrists are warning that gambling has become, and I quote, normalized and glamorized, particularly among young people, and that the psychological toll is mounting and mounting fast. So let's discuss what is obviously a crisis. I'm in conversation with Dr. James Berger, psychiatrist and member of the South African Society of Psychiatrists. James, a 623% jump, let me be accurate about the number, in calls to the helpline is astonishing. This is a full-blown mental health crisis. I'm not exaggerating, am I?
No, I thank you very much for having me at the opportunity for us to discuss this issue, because it is definitely something we're seeing growing, and the industry is now a trillion rand industry in South Africa, and along with that, we are seeing huge media and marketing push to capture us into enhancing our lives and entertainment through gambling, and that is an entertainment point of view. But along with that, it really does come with some risks, like you mentioned. That big spike is from two angles interesting, because we are seeing people are definitely needing more help with problem gambling, potentially gambling disorder, where it's become a compulsion or addiction. But also there's more help seeking as well. So it's got these two sides of it, that we are needing to help support people as they recognize their own challenges with gambling and then also seek help.
The data, if I've read it correctly, shows that 31% of gamblers exhibit problem behavior. That's up from less than 6% a year ago, and that is a spike. It not only tells us about how quickly this has all escalated, but I think it raises the question about whether the situation or even regulation and regulators are now out of their depth.
Yeah, as we say, problem gambling is something where people are moving from using it as an occasional or entertainment factor towards using increasing amounts of money, spending too much time, where it impacts our relationships, potentially gambling more than we can afford to lose. So it starts to impact on our relationships, our occupations, our communities around us. And the challenge with these types of addictive disorders is you've got people who have been got a set of behaviors that are now in place, and we often need to have regulations and policies in place to safeguard and protect our communities, to limit against the commercial drivers to target vulnerable people, and particularly young people who might not have the same ability to resist the temptation to gamble more and more. So we definitely need some policy, and I know there has been some governmental interest in how do we do that, and the gaming boards are taking on some of this, but we need them to do more as well.
So, I mean, governmental interest, and you know, some of the companies themselves doing a little bit more, given the numbers that you've just outlined to me, that is surely at this point in time completely insufficient.
I would agree with that, and obviously is going to need to come up with some creative solutions, and companies don't always do this of their own accord. So societal pressure and these types of conversations, I think, are incredibly important. We need to be having conversations about how best we can manage it. Do we need to limit advertising like we've done in other substances as well, with this being a similar type of condition that can lead to addiction and harm? Do we need to be enforcing more funds being directed and staffing resources to help with the helplines and treatment and all of those seeking? How do we best manage that? And I think there are a number of different targets we can do, and we obviously need more research about what is the most effective, but policy needs to drive it as well.
For many young men, betting, James, seems tied to identity. So sport, competition, belonging to a group. How does one address the psychological appeal of gambling without moralizing or alienating the audience that it needs to help?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point. Is often there's a moral judgment that comes with addictions, and people can often feel a lot of shame. There's a significant amount of stigma that comes at them, and that makes it really difficult to speak out to loved ones to seek help. So finding ways to make people feel comfortable enough to come forward and identify in themselves, maybe I've got some challenging behaviors that are coming out and this is affecting my life, to reach out to a friend and them having a curious and empathic conversation there. Young people and athletes probably are at higher risk. We've seen this massive spike in sports betting. I think it's about 76% in terms of year on year. And people who think that they can beat the system tend to be the highest risk for problematic gambling, where you start to chase your losses thinking that it was unlucky and next time you'll get it right. All of those types of things can be really difficult. And we're not saying that don't gamble. It's a very common, ubiquitous experience and activity that people do. We're just saying be aware of the harms. Be aware of how to set limits, take breaks, pay your monthly expenses first. Don't gamble under the influence. See how you can do it in a way that is maybe going to reduce some of the risks and what we call harm reduction in the activity.
The industry is obviously making billions. And again, a lot of debate around the figure of 750 odd million wagered last year, or billion wagered last year. Public health care systems or public health systems are carrying the cost of addictions. There is an argument that the gambling sector should be paying a greater social levy to fund treatment and awareness. But I'm probably being a little idealistic.
Well, I mean, it's always good to be idealistic and hope for the best. I think we can have these types of conversations because, as you say, they are bringing in huge amounts of money, and it has real tangible effects on our communities, and particularly if you look at our lower socioeconomic status individuals who are trying to get themselves out of poverty, and sometimes that's a driver of also trying to change their life situation. So they are more vulnerable. So we need to have implementation of regulations that say, no, you need to spend a certain amount in social responsibility. And I don't think that's unreasonable. I know they're doing some, but I think there is more that can be done.
Important conversation. Dr. James Berger, psychiatrist, member of the SA Society of Psychiatrists. Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa is facing I think, a quieter crisis than just inflation or interest rates. It's a crisis inside the minds and homes of financially stressed people. Newly released 2025 Cumulate Financial Resilience Index has put a name to it, Financial Stress Syndrome. And it shows that even households with healthy incomes are just overwhelmed. We're fatigued. We're losing confidence in our financial futures. What's worrying is nearly a third say money pressure has harmed their mental health. I wonder how you're feeling about that. Well, less than a quarter of people feel confident enough to invest. And a growing middle class is finding that managing money has become harder than earning it. I want to try and pull all of this together, but maybe let's find some silver in this cloud as well. Gary Kaler is with me, Chief Executive Officer of Worth. It's a financial education brand, and it's behind this important research. So, Gary, a very warm welcome. And this topic, I think, touches so many listeners. How did you arrive at the conclusion that stress, or financial stress syndrome, as you've called it, is now one of the defining features of our financial landscape?
What we would notice is obviously when people are highly indebted, as we see them. South Africa, you know, the average indebtedness is people are taking 80% of people's take-home pay goes towards funding salaries. And when you take a look at the metrics that we're measuring around people's dis-ease around money, we're seeing that people aren't sleeping at night. As you quoted, you know, the mental health, 29% of people are saying that they are being challenged severely around their mental health. It correlates with them saying that they're being distracted at work. So we saw that the disruption that money creates really is disrupting relationships, disrupting productivity, and also just the inability to do things. And so, you know, when it comes to solving a financial problem, having your wherewithal, coming with a measured, calm approach is what is needed. And when people are panicking and they're rocking up on the side of the field to go and say, you know, see their kids play soccer, but they're trying to put a smile on their face and actually are panicking, that's what that really feels like, and that's what that really looks like. And we can see it in the testimonials and insight from thousands of learners.
You in fact describe that person standing at the side of the football field as a person who's been exposed to middle-class poverty. Why is this group in particular, do you think, so emotionally fatigued?
Well, I think it's the level of deadlines, work pressure. It's a very aspiring bunch of people. They chased, got the education, got the job, got the income, got the job title, and yet they can't figure out why it is that the more they earn, the better they do, the harder it feels, and the harder the conversations, and the more loneliness they have around their finances, because people don't want to raise this as a problem. They just want a short-term solution. They don't have the bandwidth. So if you think about just, it's really people think it's only themselves, but it's not. It's a real me too problem. You know, if you think about just how fast the pace of life is and the lack of bandwidth to actually understand that, never mind the fact that when we teach people about money, and this is across income brackets, across education, they're literally learning things that they didn't even know they were supposed to know. So completely outgunned by the need to understand how money works, how it flows, how to transact. And especially when the pressure's on, there's even less of an ability to target the problem and work your way through it without just looking for a short-term solution to get things on track. So you can get back to work, get back to family, and get back to trying to do what you were doing.
Well, let's push that a little further then. I'm glad you used the word bandwidth. And back to that 42% of people who are constantly worried about money. And that says a lot, I imagine, about their ability to make clear financial decisions or, Gary, not to make them.
Correct. That's the point. It's in the not making it. And this is not a sport where you can just sit by and be sedentary. I mean, Discovery Bank are a big client of ours. And, you know, we see through the Vitality Money program, where if you just look at the analogy of people being physically sedentary and not doing anything about their state of their financial position, it's exactly the same with money. Credit's not sleeping. The interest rates keep, you know, just keep on charging. And people that are not doing anything about their debt position are just in a worse position. And they know it. They know it. They see the shortening cash flow. And that's why you see salary increases not touching sides. And this is why they're worrying all the time. Because, you know, we talk about, you know, living from payday to payday. But it's more like if you look at FMB statistics, it's more like from payday for the next 5 days you're living and then you're praying.
Again, back to that couch. And the longer it lasts, the more difficult I imagine it is to actually get off the couch. You'll just sink further and further into it. But there's not a quick panacea, is there?
You know, the change actually happens much faster than than you'd expect, to be honest. The measurements that we are looking at and that we're quoting are measured over a 90-day period. So when you talk about people, you know, the 42% who are always worrying about money, we see that number dropping by 44% just within 60 days. And the reason for that is that it's the fact that the unscrambling of the egg is really difficult to do. If you don't know how to do it, A, and B, you don't have a real good solid plan. So like wanting to get rid of debt and taking a shotgun approach and deciding I'm just going to pay off my creditors doesn't work. It gives you impetus for a month or two to try and stay on track, but really you need to understand the day when you're going to be debt-free so that you can work towards it in a more consistent way. And that's where the challenge is, yeah, I've tried this before. The budgeting's not working. The debt elimination is just spiraling. I'm embarrassed to talk about it. It only causes a fight at home. So like, what do I do about this? And the answer is nothing. A salary increase will help me, and do that enough times and you become exhausted.
And confidence in that respect is a pivotal factor. So when you start getting it right, I would imagine that there are immediate shifts that you start to feel when you are in more control.
Absolutely. It is about the short-term impact that you can make. So for instance, you know, we poll people and ask them a simple question. You know, are you able to save consistently from every salary? Now, some people are neutral to the question, but 34% of people say, no, I can't. I can't. Like, I'm out of salary and I can't do it. We see that number dropping by 39%. And that correlates with the same level. There's a 34% reduction in mental health dis-ease that we see. So the point is, as soon as people start getting a result, then start to see that the plan's working. And this is something that's mathematical. So if you just guide a person step by step, they can see it up front how this is going to play out. This isn't guesswork if you're doing this correctly.
So just a quick one in conclusion, what is a realistic step that I can take today to break the cycle?
I would say it's you got to be honest with yourself about, are you getting poorer or not? So, you know, every single month, are you ending up digging into salary? Are you ending up, you know, relying on credit? If that is the case, then really the distance between yourself, where you are and where you need to be, is really around financial education. It's not just pushing book. It's talking to the fact that it really is just a proper plan that you need around how do you manage money? What does the spending need to look like? What are the conversations you need to have with creditors to just get things under control? Because unbeknownst to most consumers, creditors are very open to the right conversations when you've actually got a plan saying, I can actually reduce this and pay you back your money. It's being able to take those proactive steps. I think the short-term one is need short-term savings in place, emergency funding, because life is going to continue to happen. And I think everyone needs to know that we're all human, parents, husbands, partners, and the graph is the same for all of us. It's all over the place and it's fraught with changes. And this isn't something that's just happened to you. It just really just takes some energy and effort to get on track.
Well, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, we were looking for a silver lining, and there it is. Gary Kale, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of the finance education brand Worth. I do appreciate your time. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.